Welcome to the Lost Together podcast with Matt Wardlaw.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 17 of the podcast. My guest today is Bill C. of the band Divine Weeks. And at first glance, that might not be a name that rings a bell, but you may have read Bill's book. And if you haven't read Bill's book, you really should. It was 5 years ago this month that I got an email out of the blue from Bill telling me about a book that he had written called 33 Days, Touring in a Van, Sleeping on Floors, Chasing a Dream. As a music fan, I read that title and I said, I've got to read this book. Here's the synopsis of the book that was in the email that came to me on that day. For 33 days in the summer of 1987, Los Angeles indie rock band Divine Weeks toured in a beat-up old van, sleeping on strangers' floors, never sure they'd have enough gas money to get them to the next town. No sound man, no roadies. All they have is their music and each other's friendship. 33 Days captures the essence of what it is to be 22 and chase a dream, back to a time in life when dreams don't have boundaries, when everything is possible. The tour is one of those now-or-never experiences. Take a shot at making the band work, or leave it all behind and go your separate ways. Every one of us has that moment where we have to decide either to live our dreams or give up and regret it for the rest of our lives. 33 Days touches that part of us. The road is filled with yuppies, brothels, riots, sleeping on floors, spiked drinks, DJs with no pants, and battles with racism. They set out on the road to discovery to drink in all they could and maybe sell a few records. They grew up instead. When I got the book from Bill, I finished it in about a day and a half, and I think it was probably only the commitments of life that kept me from just sitting down and powering through the whole thing in a day. It's an engaging read, and when I got to the end of it, the only thing that I wished was that I could have been around to experience the band back then. I wished that I had had the opportunity to go and see them play a show. Sometimes those wishes do in fact come true. While they're not playing a show here in my home base of Cleveland yet, Divine Weeks will be playing a show this weekend actually, on Saturday night in the Los Angeles area. I'll put a link to that show information in the show notes for this podcast episode at losttogetherpod.com. The band's going to be taking the stage to celebrate the release of a brand new Divine Weeks album called See Those Landing Lights. You can hear the music and acquire the music and find a lot of Divine Weeks information by going to their website at divineweeks.com. Here's a small taste of what you can expect from the record, which is definitely one that takes you, the listener, on a thought-provoking journey. This is the album opening track, Here's My Heart and Soul.
Home. My eyes can see again, my ears hear songs.
There you have it. That's Here's My Heart and Soul. DivineWeeks.com is where you can find information on the new record, and the band is on Facebook as well. I enjoyed finally getting the opportunity to talk to Bill. We discussed the 33 Days book and how that helped to inspire this new record, which he considers the spiritual sequel to the book. It was a good conversation, and I urge you to grab both the album and the book and spend some good time with them. And if you're in the Los Angeles area, go out and check out the Divine Weeks show this weekend. And if you're new to this podcast, check out losttogetherpod.com for a complete archive of all the shows. You can subscribe via iTunes or RSS via that website. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at Lost Together Pod, and you can email me at losttogetherpod@gmail.com. Here's today's interview. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it.
How's things on your end?
Yeah, doing pretty good. As we'll discuss this whole thing with the band just sort of came out of, you know, my book that I wrote a few years ago.
Yeah.
So very unexpectedly, it's sort of one thing beget another. So I just enjoy it. It's a unexpected opportunity, and so I'm just enjoying it.
Well, it's all very cool, and I mean, I'm glad you brought up the book, because I definitely wanted to bring that up. And I mean, that was my first introduction to the music of the band. It comes via the book. I mean, 33 days, touring in a van, sleeping on floors, chasing a dream. And as a music geek, there is no way that you see that book title and don't immediately want to read the book.
Well, good to know the meta research has paid off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do think that the book is an important part of the story as far as how we got to hearing new Divine Weeks music here in 2016. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your experience kind of putting that book together. And, you know, from what I know, you spent a long time working on it before it ever saw the light of day.
That's true. It actually, just give you just a little thumbnail sketch. You know, I cover some of my growing up in the first part of the book. And, you know, my mom was like sort of a flower child of the 60s. And, you know, so my sister was born before me, but she was given up for adoption. And she reconnected with us, you know, what's now about 20 years ago. But when she did so, she reached out to me and said, you know, write me something. And you're a writer. Write me a little letter. I mean, just sort of like tell me what I missed growing up, you know, from our mom. And, you know, I sat down and I just kept writing and writing and, you know, one thing led to another. And I gave her a call and I said, listen, I'd love to give you this, but I have to tell you, I think it turned into something else. this thing that I was trying to write you, I think I may have something here. And at the same time, I had been grappling with this journal I had found in an old box. That had, you know, the day-by-day journal I kept of our, you know, the Divine Weeks first tour back in 87.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing led to another, and I was looking and going, you know, this actually, these two things now, these two disparate projects now, I think I could weave them together and make it something kind of interesting. And, you know, so the first chapter of the book, if you will, is kind of like my letter I wrote to my sister, or what I kind of was planning to give to her. And that and the journal then became the book. It just took 12 years to put it all together. But yeah, that was how the book came together. And then I had asked my, you know, Divine Weeks guitarist, my dear friend, Raj McQuana, I asked come on the book tour. And, you know, when we were out there, it was kind of, I couldn't see myself just boring people with reading excerpts and all this. And so I said, why don't you come along? Let's play some Divine Weeks songs, just the two of us, just sort of reimagine it.
Yeah.
And so that became kind of a cool thing. And that started the healing between us. And although it took another couple of years for us to actually sit down and write again, that was kind of, you know, this new record kind of is the sequel to the book. So it's, like I said, it's a very fortuitous, unexpected bonus.
Yeah, and that's something that definitely came through reading the book, is it definitely seems like you got a lot of necessary closure regarding this band by doing the book. I mean, the thing that sticks out is, you know, you looking at, you know, the list of kind of 10 things that you'd mapped out to do with this band, and eventually realizing long after the fact that you guys actually accomplished all those things.
Yeah, that's actually one of the real aha moments, I guess, for myself. I mean, whatever anyone gets from the book, I've let that go. But for me personally, that was kind of like, why am I so hard on myself? The perfectionist, it's so vain to be caught in that sort of, oh, we didn't make it, and you beat yourself up. And I thought to myself, well, something, if I'm really going to heal, and really learn something from the past, it's that if my goals were truly, that exact, like, for those who didn't read the book, the 10 things, they seem modest now, but at the time it was like, just get a gig in Hollywood, get played on the local college radio station, get signed to a minor label. We never wanted to be any more than big in the Replacements. Just these were our goals, and we weren't that big. But, I'm saying they were modest goals by today's standards. And to find that little list, as I was writing the book, I went, well, screw me. How dare I, beat myself up over this? And this is actually a revelation. I actually did reach these things. And that doesn't make us a success to anybody else but myself. And it was nice to find that. And who's the hardest ass but yourself? And that was really the thing that opened up the door and let me see the past for what it was.
As far as the journaling process that kind of led to the book, were you somebody that, like, as a kid, like, did you keep journals? Was that something that was just kind of normal for you?
Really? Exactly. Okay. A big sort of like grab the nearest napkin and scratch out the latest thing you're thinking of, and then just to preserve it, and then go home and put it in the journal. That's from my mom. There's a moment in the record, in the book where, she says, we had no choice. We're wounded birds. We're artists. You have no choice. You have to get it out. And he's a far better writer than I. But I always took that to heart. I was always on the run and writing, just get it all down.
I really appreciated that because I was somebody that, as a kid, like, I tried a couple times to keep a diary, but it was never something I was able to stick with. So it's like I've always been really impressed with people that are able to kind of like stay married to that. And it leaves you, obviously, all of these years later, in the case of you, it leaves you with a cool book like this. Other people, like, it just gives you interesting stuff to look back on if you can, maintain that. And obviously now today it's like, we have Facebook, we have whatever else, we have blogs, this and that. Like, so that's kind of the stuff that, like, we can look back at, but it's just like, I don't know that, like, people who are growing up today necessarily have that appreciation for how difficult it used to be to have to, kind of maintain a record of what was going on.
No question. No question. I mean, for me, it's like, what's the old phrase, stand for something, you fall for anything.
Yep.
So it's kind of like, that's the way I always looked at journals. Like, it forces me to look at something that, and that I'm holding myself accountable almost. These are my feelings. I'm getting them down. It doesn't matter if no one else is reading it. It's vitally important that I'm reading it.
Where did the writing come in for you? Like, did you see that journaling? Did you see that start to, like, transition into something that you wanted to do more with?
Ooh, well, I always loved music, so I did try the music critic thing.
Yeah.
That was one thing. I still enjoy writing about music. What I didn't like was starting to play out and be a music critic and be critical of my peers.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that. You got to be honest. But I didn't feel that I could do that well, because I knew that the baby steps of my band was gloriously awkward and falling all over ourselves. So I didn't want to be at the same time, doing that, but I've always enjoyed writing music, and that's something I still do, and so that did transition into a brief music critic career. The book I always wanted to do, but as I said, I think the book that I did end up writing only worked because of a degree of synchronicity, and as I say, it's very fortuitous, unexpected. It was just two things that collided at the right moment. I think that's why I think my book is, if it's good at anything, it doesn't feel self-conscious. It just feels like a bunch of people sitting around or standing around in a kitchen house party. And that's, I'm just talking about something I was fortunate to have experienced. You know, I'm just lucky that our tour ended up being rather extraordinary. And I think the set of circumstances were such that it made it interesting on a universal level. But had I just sat down and say, I'm a writer, you know, I'm going to write a book. I mean, like, to me, that makes it hard. That makes it too self-conscious. And so I think I've always looked at the book that I did write was just, I was kind of lucky just to have been there. And I shut up long enough to just make myself sit down and say, this needs to come out. And,
Yeah. And it's interesting because, I think what I really liked about the book is that it illustrates a story that we don't hear about as often, but it's one that's familiar to a lot of bands, and that is the struggle that is involved with being on tour and what goes into making it from town to town and from show to show, all the individual pieces and parts that have to happen for that to come together, for gas to go into the van, for the band to get paid right. for the shows, for the band to get right. paid what they're supposed to get paid for those shows, and, you know, maintaining right. relationships both at home and within the band itself, on the road, et cetera. Like, I mean, it's a really interesting, revealing read for folks that just buy albums and don't really look any deeper than that. You know, it really kind of opens up what kind of goes on process-wise behind the scenes. And kind of adding to that, I just wondered, we talked about social media just a passing mention, but if Divine Weeks had been a functioning band today with cell phones and social media and everything else, how different do you think the storyline would have been based on, like, the complexity of, like, the personalities that made up the band?
Well, that's a question. After the book came out, you know, Rod and I asked ourselves that quite a bit, just saying, you know, what if, you know, and of course we've just put out a new record, and, you know, to a degree we're seeing that, but to answer your question, I mean, the then versus now argument, I mean, you have the cost of gas, that's big.
Right.
I mean, that's the one that first comes to mind, because really it was, I'm not kidding, it was a challenge knowing, are we going to have enough gas to get to the next town? I mean, mm-hmm. there were moments like that. There were moments we were screwed out of our guarantee, where we were literally just standing there, you know, just saying, like, well, we can't tuck our tail between our legs and just say, oh, well, I mean, we literally need this money now, you know? And so, you know, we're not exactly imposing figures, you know? So,
right.
you know, to ballot out with, you know, some goon, you know, that was new to us. And this is really the first time we were ever outside of the house. You know, or, you know, outside of the town, you know, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so it was, we were green as toads. We were over our skis, out of our element, but there was no just curling up into the fetal position and accepting it. So it was a crash course and challenging, and we grew up fast. But to answer your question, though, how would it be different now? I mean, the thing is that a lot of people don't realize that in the mid-'80s, it was still kind of this little cottage industry of touring in a van. And the information we disseminated was just reading, like, interviews and fanzines of, like, Black Flag saying, yeah, we just looked on the label of this little 45 of this band we liked in North Carolina. So we called them up and said, hey, can we just play a show with you?
And oh, yeah.
That's the level it was.
Yep.
You know, and then when you come back our way, you play with us. And so we just literally, and just like, where do you stay? Oh, well, you just call this guy. Here's his number. Here, and he scratches out a little piece of paper. This guy in, you know, Greensboro will let you crash on his floor. And so that's the ground war, taking it into the hinterlands, finding converts one by one. That was what we went off. And we found out either by word of mouth or, you know, standing next to somebody at a club while the Minutemen played, you know, and, oh, wow, you did this. And that's how it was. And now, I mean, you can literally just Google touring in a van, you know, and there's 5,000, you know, Google search results. And I'm not saying it makes it easier, but it's just the immediacy of the information is staggering. And like when, or the other thing, like long distance phone calls. That used to cost an enormous amount of money.
Yep.
Now that's not even an issue. Right before we went, we'd buy a bunch of stolen calling cards. People probably don't even know what that is. And we'd buy like 30 of them and like use them until somebody would find out. You know, the same thing, renting a van, you know, the cost of gas or the rental cost, we just disconnect the odometer, you know, which is right. A federal crime, by the way. So it was all these little things, and you just learn on the run. And would it have been different now? I just don't know. I mean, certainly we could have sustained ourselves through, like, making your own stickers and your own records and T-shirts, and you could have had some immediate income from just selling those at gigs. That's the one that I think comes to mind the most. You could have sustained yourself a little better, or you can sustain yourself better now, at least in terms of immediate cash flow.
Well, at the time that you start riding with Raj in 2014, it's not based around the idea of doing a Divine Weeks album. What was the intention at that point?
Like I said, I had taken him on the book tour. We thought about writing again. It took a couple years to get back to that. We knew we wanted to play a show again. Like, let's start with one show. And the first thought actually was, let's play a show of covers. Let's do a show called Songs That Saved Us. You know, the songs that gave us comfort or whatever. And we kicked that around, and then he finally said, well, why don't we just write our own songs that save us, but not for the past, for now. Like, let's write songs that are benchmarks for today, and it just sort of take on, like, the core elemental parts of our lives right now. You know, like fatherhood, spirituality, if you will, mortality, soulmates, you know, friendship, things like that. Things that are just crucial to us now. And so, okay, so I knock on his door, August 2014, no thoughts of Divine Weeks, just let's see if we can just get out the shovel and start digging. And, you know, that first song we wrote day one came sort of like eerie and like this, that's not the word, but sort of frighteningly easy. And it was like the song you write and you wonder, well, who's talking in the song and to whom? Because it was like this song that was reaching out saying, why are you pretending you don't need this? Why don't you get back to what you really are? Stop fooling yourself. You can't fool me. And, of course, the voice is me. It's me understanding I need to go back and rescue that guy, you know, who didn't think or had convinced himself he didn't need music. And that was the first song on the record called Here's My Heart and Soul. And that sets up a series of these. It's like a litany of things that I need to strip away. You know, the notion of the soulmate. Like, I can't go on living thinking I have to be saved by someone. That's another one. The next song is Built My Life Around You. That's for my daughter. I have to let her go. I just dropped her off to New York, and I come back, and I'm left with myself. What am I going to do with myself? I have to let that go. There's another song, Blind Kind of Love, which is, if it's not about God, it's about the God narrative. I got to let that go. You know, I've got to get into this idea of self-formation and recreate myself in the here and now, and it's just about stripping away all those things that prevent you from being who you truly are. And that's basically what the record's about.
Yeah, and I know you're an album guy, and hearing you talk, I mean, it seems like you definitely mapped this out pretty specifically, which is something that I definitely heard listening to the record. I mean, the way the record starts off, and certainly See Those Landing Lights is such a perfect name for the record, very appropriate for the visual of this band kind of returning home, getting back to business. And right. That's something that pops up in the lyrics of Big Sky, which, you know, closes the record. And, you know, by the time you've gotten to that point, it definitely feels like a very appropriate wrapping point. So, like, how did that piece of things kind of develop as far as mapping it out as an album? Like, did that kind of reveal itself as you guys were working through the songs? Or was that after you'd already been to the studio and all that kind of stuff?
No, that was, that definitely was an early thought. Like I said, a benchmark of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know how it's going to turn out. But there was a conscious effort to do a coherent piece. And you know, I think it was the third song we wrote was Big Sky. And that was one of those, like, in a lifetime, if you're lucky, you get a song that just kind of lands kind of magically and writes itself. And you hear about that, but you say, I wish that would happen. Maybe it's not true, but wouldn't it be cool if it did? But that was one of those songs that really did kind of just, I don't know, it just one of those things. And it was weird because, like, there was no lyrics to any of the songs. Every Sunday morning, I'd knock on Roger's door and say, well, I got nothing. And he'd laugh and say, come on in. I got nothing either. And he'd just start playing. And, you know, like I read this interview with Marvin Gaye where he said, you know, I just sort of like, I let the band sort of groove on something and then I just wait for my mumbles to turn into words. And that always struck me as something I'd really love to try and put into play. And that's kind of what was going on in these songs. And so we'd record everything, and then I'd go and listen on my phone. I'd be driving around. I'd go, you know, like you'd hear a word or a phrase pop up in these, like, little imaginary language I was sort of babbling in. And you'd hear, like, Big Sky or See Those Landing Lights or, you know, the little things. And then, I'd finish them at home later. But Big Sky was like this evocative image, this wide-open, hopeful place for renewal. And See Those Landing Lights is like this beacon-like lighthouse of sorts that carries you home. But the thing is that I learned making the rest of the record as we kept digging, it's not just about making it back home. It's about once there, you know, reclaiming yourself. Hmm. You know, like I said, kind of a self-formation or self-reformation, as the case may be. And, you know, personally, for me, it's about, like I said, becoming an artist again, if that doesn't sound too highfalutin.
Not at all. And it seems like the Sunday morning, like, songwriting sessions, it seems like there was a conscious effort to kind of block out that time. Was that, like, something that was a usual thing back in the day when the band was active, that you guys had, like, that kind of discipline, that you, something that you wanted to get back to? Or what part did that play in things, how you kind of mapped that part of things out?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because, like, when people, like, ask, you know, who inspired your sound? Like, that's one of those generic questions you always get.
Right.
And the funny thing is, like, I remember specifically talking with Raj the first day, and we were, like, we were both on, like, this Motown obsession at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Four Tops or Smokey Robinson, Supreme, stuff like that. And the funny thing is, you can't really hear any of that in any of these songs except for maybe a teeny bit on Built My Life Around You, which is kind of poppy. But it kind of gave us that same discipline, the songwriting discipline. Like we were talking about that, it made us really get rid of all the flab. You know, like there's a couple epics at the end of the record, but the crux of every song is I think, very, you can hear that obsession with making sure there's no wasted notes, no wasted words. Everything has to be a crucial thing. And if you took it away, sort of like the foundation would slip away. And so, I don't know if I answered your question, but that's something that we always did in the old days. And so even though we never meant for this to be a Divine Weeks record, there was an eerie familiarity with the kind of approach we defaulted to that was always about get the most crucial elements down. And, you know, I think that carried through.
So you guys are writing, like, say, starting in, like, August of 2014, and as I understand it, you went in to, like, record stuff in the beginning of this year. So what was kind of the trigger point that finally said to you guys, like, okay, it's time, let's go in and actually record this stuff?
We knew we wanted to record. We knew it was good, and we wanted to play a show. That was the goal. We want to play one great show. That was the first goal. And, you know, we had 10 songs, and we couldn't stand not hearing drums and bass anymore. And so, you know, we brought Divine Weeks drummer, Dave, in, because he's great. and couldn't imagine playing with anyone else. Our original bass player, George Evanson, he's now a rock star of the classroom. He's a big-time professor at Dartmouth, so couldn't do that. But we got, you know, another good friend, Steve Soto, to come in and play. we knew we wanted to record, but we still weren't sure the world wanted to hear Divine Weeks in 2016. But essentially what happened was David Bowie died.
Yeah.
At the beginning of this year. And, you know, to find out that he, after being given a death sentence, had gotten busier than ever and, you know, recorded like a madman and essentially left us all with the message, carpe diem, seize the day, mm-hmm. get busy, don't waste another minute, get started on whatever it is you're not doing yet, act now. That essentially was like this resounding, like booming voice, and it hovered over the making of this record and definitely had everything to do with this thing, we are Divine Weeks, we have to. You know, it was like, we got to be who we are. Why are we thinking too much about this? You know, and that was really the precipitating event that pushes forward. And I guess to have the courage to say, yeah, I don't care if you want a Divine Weeks record. In 2016, we're doing it.
Yeah, I definitely got that sense that it was like, this is a record that you guys did as much for yourselves as you did for the fans, whoever those folks might be, that would want to hear it, like, which is cool. That's the best place to start from when you do a record, is just to do it because you want to do it.
What do they say in sports? For love of game?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Bowie thing, I mean, you know, as a music fan, it's just, there's a lot of people talking about it, but it's just been an unbelievable year, you know, just the people we've been losing. But it was a very profound way to start off the year, seeing how he had mapped out kind of his final act. I mean, that record, like,
incredible.
It was a record that I enjoyed a lot when I first heard it. And then suddenly a couple days later when he passes, it's like, then you're listening to those songs again going, oh my God, it's all right there. You know?
Well, the video to Lazarus is just incredible. Probably the most extraordinary video ever made, short of Johnny Cash's Hurt.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, to see him, that scene where he's furiously writing at the desk and then he looks upward and then there's that little brief moment where he gets up and he does his little David Bowie dance and he goes back in the closet. I mean, I don't know. There's no words.
What was it like for you getting back in the studio with the band?
Well,
and the album itself seems like it came together pretty quickly.
Recorded the backing tracks in one day.
Nice.
And we never did that before. I mean, we did a lot of overdubs and we mixed one a day carefully. But the actual meat and potatoes is one day, and that's no joke. And we've never done that before. So we were very efficient. We made sure not to go in there with, you know, thoughts of let's make Sgt. Pepper's or any of that garbage, you know. We want to record a immediate, connecting, no BS, right to the heart record. And that means we want to sound like us, like we do on stage. And that's the thing. Divine Weeks was a pretty good band, never made a good record, played some great shows out on the road, never in the studio at the right moment. And, you know, if you would have recorded us with a cassette player, you know, in Dayton, Ohio, you know, you might have heard something that sounded like us that we'd be proud of. But too much ambition, not enough vision, not enough discipline, way back in the day recording. And this was the exact opposite. We just, let's make a great sounding record that is going to sound like we play live.
Well, then this record, I mean, just the fact that you have this record has to be a really rewarding thing if you felt that way about the records you guys had done in the past. Like, you know, that seems like definitely something that would weigh on you if you felt like you'd never captured it, to be able to go and finally capture that here all these years later. I mean, that's got to be really gratifying.
Absolutely. And just on a personal basis, because I dearly love my bandmates, Dave is such a great drummer. He was never captured on record like that. Raj, who is my best friend in the world, to hear him play that well, I'm just very happy for them. So the world can hear what I know is true. And it's not about saying, you know, me pumping up Divine Weeks. It's on a personal basis. My friends sound great, and that makes me happy.
I love the way the record starts off, too, because you have that intro to hears My Heart and Soul, which kind of seems to signal that things are going one way, but then you guys count it off and it kicks in and goes somewhere completely different. So
yeah, I like that. I like that. And that's Raj.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Very cool. So now that we're holding this record, what are the plans kind of going forward? I know obviously there's the release show.
So that's May 21st here in town, Los Angeles, that is. I know you're back there in Ohio.
Yep.
But, it's at a place called Fay Dodo. It's an old jazz haunt of Coltrane and Billie Holiday. No coincidence that we chose that place. Nice ghosts hanging out there.
Yeah.
And it's a free show, which we wanted to do. We're filming it, too. Beyond that, I don't know. There may be more. At this very minute, I'm just trying to get, working like a demon to just try and get some love for this record. And leading up to that show, we're going to do video and film that show. And beyond that, I'm not sure. It could be more. I don't want to say.
It's a tidy 10-track record. Did you have more songs than that?
No, we didn't. We recorded everything and it was always meant to be 10 songs and not like doing these 70-minute records with 6 extra songs that don't really need to be there. It's really kind of meant to be like an old LP.
Yeah, it definitely has that feel. That's really cool. Oh, very cool. Well, I have to ask you.
Yeah. Nobody listens to those anymore, even though I spent all this time sequencing it like an old LP.
But what? I mean, for fellow music geeks like us that do appreciate the art of that, I mean, that's something that definitely does come through listening to this record, that there was actual effort, put into making it feel like a record as opposed to here's the 10 songs that we had,
Well, thanks, Matt. That means a lot. I know you're hip to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to ask you because this conversation was postponed, and on the day that we were supposed to talk, that's when the news breaks that Prince had passed away, and you posted your tale about seeing Prince for the first time opening for the Stones at the Coliseum in 81. Right. I mean, that's a legendary occurrence. I mean, that sounds like that was quite an experience for you.
The funny thing is there's almost nothing about that.
Yeah.
I would have thought there'd be more photos or... Like, the only photo that really exists is, I don't even see it. It's from the peristyle end of the Coliseum looking out in the crowd, and Prince has already walked off the stage.
Right.
And my memory, my indelible memory etched on my brain of that show is, and I'm not kidding, there was so much crap in the air at the same time. It was, just like fireflies, except there were bottles and hot dogs, and it was ugly. I mean, it really was. And there's no photos of it. It's mind-blowing. But, I mean, you post something like that, and a whole bunch of your friends, I was there, and, I remember that. And really, to not bring this down, but, I mean, it really was ugly. It was racist. It was so obvious. It was very homophobic. It was the worst that you could ever see in a crowd. I posted, it was the Marlboro and Coors crowd, just ugly Hell's Angels kind of thing, it was as bad as it gets. And I was not really hip to Prince, but all I know is I was looking up going, that's so punk rock, that is incredible. He was playing so amazing, and he was, in the trench coat and the panties and the high heels. I'm just like, I cannot believe how amazing this is. And of course, in a couple of years, he was looking down from a throne, ruling the world. I mean, how good must have that felt?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it certainly at that point, the show you're talking about reveals, how much of a performer he already was that, talk about all the projectiles in the air, and it's like he just, in today's day and age where somebody might walk off the stage and, middle fingers and all that, he soldiered through. He kept playing,
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think he knew, you're going to get yours and I'm going to get mine. That's what I really feel.
So was that the same show that, as I understand it, Jay Giles' band was also on that show?
Yeah, it was Jay Giles, George Thorogood,
jeez,
and Prince.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a typically interesting Rolling Stones cocktail of music.
Exactly. I remember Bill Graham coming out and shouting at everyone after Prince left. Bill Graham rubs people the wrong way, but, you know, props to him. He told everyone off, and of course they didn't want to hear it, but I also remember that. As I understand it, Mick is the one, I'm pretty sure Mick is the one who personally chose Prince to tour with him. I'm not sure how many shows he did, but I think it was he.
That sounds about right. I mean, that, you know, it, for me, it would be a toss-up because you could see either Mick or Keith or both Mick and Keith, you know, picking Prince.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so. God knows Mick absolutely, you know, was obsessed with Prince.
Right.
I mean, that's very clear.
Yep.
Yeah. Not a bad thing.
Not at all. No, no. Did you have an opportunity to see a lot of, like, Bill Graham-type productions?
Well, I mean, you know, his heyday goes back a little bit before my time. I didn't see any of those Fillmore shows, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, he did sell. Well, the Amnesty Tour, I guess, would have been one of the last things I would have seen him do. The first Amnesty Tour.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that was good.
Well, what else is, besides this current, like, Divine Week stuff, what else is coming up for you?
Like I said, like, one of the songs on there, like I told you, is about my daughter. Dropping her off in New York, so I'm going to fly out to New York tomorrow to see a play of hers, an all-female production of Lord of the Flies.
Oh, cool.
So I'm looking forward to that. You know, it's good to see, like, my daughter has a lot more game than I did at you know, at the same age, and, you know, I'll just be a humble attendee and watch her do her thing. You know, people always ask me, didn't you want to push her, like, into music? And I'm like, I'm just glad she has the arts in her at all, that it means something. Like, I'm always amazed, like, even if you're not, like, great or gifted, like, I can never understand when people say, oh, I don't like movies, or I don't like music, or I don't like, you know, sculpture. Like, I don't know how else you can find your inner self if you don't at least dive into the arts. So I'm just glad that means something to her.
Yeah, it's very cool. Like, in the stuff I've seen you, you know, post, like, you know, it's obvious she's doing, you know, good things, and, you know, seems like you're in a good place. I mean, seems like everything's good.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just, day after day, I wake up and say, make me do it a little bit better today. That's what I do. And so, you know, I just, after being really hard on myself for, you know, all those old, you know, records that I told you weren't good enough,
mm-hmm.
It's nice that the last two things I've done are the two things I'm most proud of, you know, to do that kind of later in life. You know, the book and this Divine Weeks record, I'm very proud of. And I'm, like I said, they came out of not really expecting it to happen. And so I guess I should take that as a hint to not grind and gnash my teeth if things don't come easily. You know, they'll come when they come.
I think that's one of the things where we're always kind of like, a lot of folks have a hard time, like, remembering that. You know, it's like you're always kind of just, like, trying to force things, and the reality is that, like, the things happen when they're supposed to and when you're not expecting them to.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, cool, man.
You know, I appreciate the opportunity to come on today, Matt.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun, and, you know, we'll look forward to seeing where, you know, things go with all this, but it's been cool to see. It looks like the actual record's getting good reception so far, so that's cool to see.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's enough darkness in the world. We just want to reach for the light, make some joyful and triumphant music. If anybody wants to hear it, it's there for them. Try to make it easy as possible to hear it, and we know we're not going to make money from it, so if you want to have it, hit me up, and I'll make sure it happens.
And what's the website? It's just divineweeks.com, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. That's kind of an important thing for us to throw out so that folks listening to this can, you know, go and, you know, find information on the band and all that kind of stuff, and you guys are on Facebook and all that, so.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are Facebook, and then just divineweeks.com, and, you know, the record's everywhere. If you want to overpay and make sure we get no royalties, please go on Spotify and iTunes and Amazon. But, you know, if you find it for cheaper, and there's a lot of ways to do it, hint, hint, absolutely go for it. That makes my day.
Nice. Awesome. Well, hey, man, thank you so much for taking the time, and, you know, we'll look forward to seeing where it all goes.
Totally. Really appreciate it, Matt. Best to your better half.